This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. First up, a huge, huge thank you to Jeff for another excellent edition of On The Record. He'll be back next week, but you can catch On The Record every weekday here at RTR FM from 9 in the AM. My name is Raymond Grenfell, and a bit of a full house comparatively to the it's usually just me and Brahma, but we got a bit of a crew in today. Ewan and Lulu are in the studio as well. How's it going?
Good morning, Ray. Good morning, listeners. Lulu, do you want to say hello? No, she's having a good time spinning around on the chair. Fair enough.
You can hang out with Brahma and keep up the good vibes of the show. You always need, you know, a few silent partners in radio. Good to be here this week. A bit of a jam-packed show for you all this morning. We're going to be carrying on a conversation, well, that Jeff was just having there on the record, and we discussed also last week. And I think it's, you know, while it might seem like we're doubling up a little bit, it's important to really get into this issue, and that is the proposed changes at UWA. Last week, we spoke to a representative from the UWA Guild about the cuts to anthropology, sociology, and otherwise. And this week, we're going to be speaking to one of the members of the staff there at UWA who is going to be directly affected by the proposed changes and some of his research. But we're also going to be talking to him a bit about his, specifically a bit about his research and, yeah, some of the impacts these cuts will have on that. We're also going to be talking a little bit about the 8-year anniversary of the changes to our immigration policy. There were some protests over the weekend as refugee advocates in Brisbane gathered outside the immigration centre to mark the, I think it's 8 years of indefinite detention. And that is that was introduced by the Rudd government about 8 years ago, where they declared that anyone who came by boat to Australia would never be settled in Australia. And that really led to all the issues around Manus Island and Nauru and people being forced to settle in PNG and so forth. So to find out about that and, you know, just to get a general update in terms of refugee advocacy and refugee rights in this country, a little later in the show, we're going to be speaking to a longtime refugee advocate and activist in Rintoul. And Ewan?
After that, no. What? Second up maybe in the show. We're going to be speaking to Andy Grice. He's one of a group of defendants in court this week as part of their Extinction Rebellion action. They interrupted the passage of a piece of legislation in Parliament. They were, of course, arrested and now are in court this week, and they are pleading not guilty on the basis of what they did, they say, was an emergency defence for our planet. So we'll be hearing from Andy about that case this week.
This is the Indie Media Show with myself, Raymond Grenfell, Ewan Buckley, and our vibe keepers, Lulu and Brahma, in the studio. Now, if you caught On The Record earlier this morning, you would have heard a conversation regarding the proposed cuts to UWA's social sciences, specifically targeting departments such as sociology and anthropology, but affecting a lot of researchers. One of those researchers that is potentially going to be affected by these proposed cuts is Dr. Teal Harper. Dr. Teal Harper is a teacher and researcher with the Media and Communications Department at UWA, and he joins us on the line now. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us this morning, Dr. Harper.
It's lovely to be here, Ray.
Now, as I said there, these proposed cuts and changes are going to have a huge impact on many staff, students, and the broader university community at UWA. And before we get into those cuts, though, and those, I guess, the proposed changes and what effects that will have, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your research, just to give our listeners a bit of an idea of, you know, the I guess, the kind of research that may be affected?
Yeah, okay. Thanks. I'm a researcher in public communication, so I did my thesis on the lack of critical thinking in democratic systems, and I'm a kind of communications expert, if you like. But I also do a lot of research into like social media analytics, policy and public communication and hundreds of things, to be honest.
Totally. And I guess your research broadly falls under the context of public interest research. And public interest research in of itself is, I guess, in a difficult position because unlike, you know, perhaps mining research or research into other forms of, I guess, so-called profitable industries, there is a problematic relationship, I guess, with funding already in universities. Has that already been your experience, I guess, as a public interest researcher?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of funding for research that supports the interest of either the government or industries. And as a result, there's a kind of related lack of funding for anything that is likely to be critical of government or critical of industry's interests. So, that's hopefully quite clear to listeners that people will pay for research, but they often have a very defined objective when they pay for research. And what's been proposed under this new proposal is that you get research that people will pay for, but you don't research anything that people don't want to pay for.
Totally. And as you said there, obviously, if you're researching things that are perhaps in ideological or economic contrast to the government's own agenda or perhaps to some of the corporations' agenda, that can be quite difficult. These proposed cuts have been introduced supposedly under the premise of a bit of a recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic. There's been huge impact on the university sector related to the COVID-19 pandemic. Do you buy any of the logic from the university that, you know, something has to give and that, you know, that there are cuts that need to be made in order to, you know, to maintain doors open and students attending UWA?
In one hand, I can buy the narrative. I mean, this is essentially a result of Morrison and Tehan's cuts to education that were introduced in Parliament last year. So in a way, the university, which has been defunded continuously by every government for the last 20 years, the university sector, is crippled and in trouble. So I buy the fact that obviously something needs to change, but what I can't accept at all is the internalized logic that, oh, what we need to cut is the public interest research and the research that actually provides critical capacity for the community. And what we need to support is the research that already gets a lot of money from industry. That for me is actually a backward step and opposite to the university's public role.
And I guess talking about that public role, I mean, the role of universities in general, I guess for many of our listeners and for ourselves, we've always thought of universities as a place that really nurtures critical faculty and nurtures the ability to, you know, I guess have space and time to critically reflect on government and institutions and our world in general. Do you see these changes that, well, you know, to be honest, have been ongoing for decades in our university sector, but do you see them as part of a broader shift towards a more neoliberal approach to teaching and to education and to universities, in which essentially if something isn't going to profit industry or profit government, then it's not worth studying or researching?
Yeah, well, obviously, I mean, cutting sociology and anthropology entirely and defunding research in things like communication and media and Asian studies are an expression of that neoliberal ideology that, of course, has come to dominate political conversations and kind of public thought over the last 20 years. I mean, this is exactly what my core research is about. So for me, it's a very sensitive topic. So yeah, definitely. Of course, what are the mechanisms or the measures that a community or a country has to resist that kind of infiltration? Well, teaching things like critical thinking or deep theoretical consideration of topics is a one form of social resistance. And you better believe that Morrison's kind of plan to defund universities at this particular point of vulnerability is intended to stop critical thinking. It is intended to kill critical thinking off just at the point where there's a sign of weakness.
We're talking to Dr. Tul Harper, who is a researcher and academic at UWA's Media and Mass Communications Department. Now, Dr. Harper, you're talking there about vulnerability and also about social resistance. For many of us, we know that the university sector has been gutted over the last few decades, and that has not just had an impact on staff and students and on the, the quality of teaching and the quality of industrial rights and wages, but it's also had a huge impact on the student culture. For some of us, we may remember, you know, university campuses in the early 2000s or late 90s when there was a really vibrant activist culture on campus. You had the huge demonstrations against the invasion of Iraq and also the demonstrations against compulsory fees, student fees and so forth. And there really seemed to be a real kind of vibrant activist culture on campus. Sadly, I don't think that is so much the case today. And would you, I guess, agree that that's something that's happened as a process of this kind of neoliberalization of universities, is that that student activism or that critical thinking has somewhat been lost? And or do you see some form of, I guess, resurgence of that on campus? Or can you perhaps see a resurgence of it in response to these latest attacks?
Well, I have to say, we had a protest on Friday at UWA about these changes, and it was so gratifying to see so many people, staff and students, there. It was raining, but it was still hundreds and hundreds of people there, furious at what's happened. So for me, that was the most kind of warming experience to see that despite that lack of campus culture and that lack of student kind of resistance, there's everyone is still really upset at these potential changes. So, but having said that, I actually was one of those 90s and 2000 students myself. We have had to kind of engage in this long march through education as educators. We've had to make sure that everything that we teach leads directly to employment, that we ask as little as we possibly can from students in terms of their commitment to what they're studying, but also deliver them these particularly employable outcomes, because that is what the government's rhetoric has been about. Like, this is what we're looking for. We're looking for employment. We're looking for job-ready graduates and so on. So we've kind of had to strip a lot of the critical stuff out of our education anyway, unfortunately. It's still there. It's still being protected by people such as myself. But this is the final kind of blow to kind of say, no, you can't even have that. Even if you're successful, even if you're creating a great program, even if you're training job-ready graduates, we can't even allow you to think critical thought. So it's grim. It's grim.
I guess just finally, Dr. Harper, though, you know, this, you know, hopefully, as you said there, the hundreds of people that turned out in opposition to these proposed changes last week, and clearly a bit of a movement building around opposing these changes to the social sciences at UWA, that there is, you know, certainly something building. And even if there is some positive, I guess, change in regard to these particular cuts, it's obviously a part of a much broader attack in the university sector. And as you're discussing there, this is something that has been ongoing for decades. Do you foresee, I mean, what possible, positive outcome can come of this? And looking at, I guess, the COVID-19 pandemic and perhaps the need for some restructuring, what alternatives are there? I mean, I suggested last week when we were just talking to the student guild that perhaps, you know, some of the upper management could take a pay cut rather than sacking staff and gutting departments.
Yeah, look, I mean, that's a great one. I'm all for realistic goals. Good governance mechanisms within the university would make a huge difference in changes. Forcing the federal government to understand how important public education is as a resource. Universities are currently funded less than private schools. Which for me just boggles my mind, that private school system is supposedly for people who want to pay more because they're so dissatisfied with public education. Why subsidise that more than public education, with which has a public research benefit? That for me is a clear kind of betrayal of principle that we should be holding our government to account for. So there's, you know, in a way they've shown their hand to kind of say, look, our model of the future is specious and vacuous. So hopefully people realise that, and hopefully people start voting in terms of, you know, yeah, in terms of what good could come of this, actual good governance processes at the university. This proposal for change has been developed in a really non-consultative way. It contains a complete misunderstanding of both the public, the university's public role, its role, the role of education, and also, you know, things like what my discipline does is just completely misrepresented in this document. And so all of that can be resolved by actually saying, look, let's know, let's be consultative, let's think about the university's engagement with the community, let's think about student experience and work upwards from that. And unfortunately, that's going to be a big change.
We've been speaking to Dr. Teo Harper, who is a researcher, teacher and academic at the Media and Communications Department at UWA. Thank you very much for speaking to us this morning, Dr. Harper.
Thank you very much, Ray. It's a pleasure.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
Well, last year, a group of Extinction Rebellion activists disrupted Parliament House. They went into the Parliament and stood up, glued themselves, allegedly, to the balustrade and stood there to speak their piece, disrupting the passage of a bill that would see the expansion of the Woodside's Northwest Gas Development and the Burrup Hub. And we're speaking today with Andy Grice, one of those activists. And a small disclaimer here, I am an active member of Extinction Rebellion. And Andy is one of our colleagues. Andy, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
But thanks for joining us, mate. I wonder if you would start off by describing, I guess, the motivations and what you folks did in the Parliament that day.
Okay, the development that we were protesting was an expansion. It was an expansion in the Burrup Hub national gas, no, the gas hub, and it's going to add about 20 million tonnes per annum of pollution to the atmosphere and up to 80 million tonnes extra when the gas gets sent overseas and burned. And it's going to be bigger than the Adani coal mine by several times in its pollution effects. And it does mean that we cannot possibly meet our Kyoto agreements to minimise our pollution levels, and certainly can't meet the Paris Accords, even that, and that's a pretty mild reduction goal of about 25 to 26 to 28%. So we are trying to protest this expansion, and we expected to get arrested, and we were.
Of course, opposition is, you know, mounting against the further development of the Northwest gas resources. The International Energy Agency have come out to say that we really can't keep global temperatures below 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial conditions if we continue to develop any more fossil fuel resources. And up here in Western Australia, on the Northwest Shelf at the Burrup Peninsula, this development would further destroy the Murujuga art, thousands of years old, millions of pieces of petroglyphs. The Woodside have already been responsible for destroying through the 1980s as the development went ahead. Traditional owners of the area are very disappointed that more destruction may be imminent, as we see with the Juukan Gorge catastrophe this year. These things are kind of par for the course in Western Australia. This Conservation Council are engaged with the Environmental Defender's Office to challenge the legitimacy of the state government's approvals processes. And you people went in there directly to challenge the passage of the bill. You're in court this week and, You know, the usual thing for protesters is to, you know, do their thing, be arrested, go to court, plead guilty, get it over and done with as quick as possible. But you people have been challenging your arrest and the charges against you. I wonder if you could explain what's happening in court this week.
Yeah, we're, we are pleading not guilty. We admit that, hey, we did go into Parliament, we did disrupt Parliament, we did glue our hands onto the gallery railing, and we did refuse to leave, mainly we claimed because we glued to the railing. And yeah, so we plead, we're basically guilty of the crime of trespass, which is what we got charged with. But we're pleading not guilty on the grounds of, hey, we were actually attempting to raise awareness of the issue and its extreme urgency. And we're defending ourselves on the basis of, yeah, we were acting in an emergency situation. And at that stage, laws can be broken. I could break into your house and grab you and haul you out. And that would be normally regarded as fairly criminal. But if your house was on fire, it becomes okay. And what we're claiming is, hey, the climate is suffering so badly that we must do actions, even if they do break a law in the right here and now, for better good later on. And so, yeah, we're appealing this charge on the basis of, hey, yeah, we were reacting to a climate emergency. And if, hey, the other aspect of it is, hey, a couple of years ago, I got arrested and charged and at court, and the magistrate said, yes, I believe the climate science and I believe your sincerity in it, but hey, it was an inappropriate way of addressing the urgency of it. And so this time around, we're also arguing that, hey, there is no other valid method for us to express the urgency of it, to get the knowledge out to people, to get everyone aware of what's happening, than to say, yeah, it's a climate emergency and we are addressing it in a non-violent manner, but it needs public support and there's no other way for us to do it. And so we're running also on the fact that not only is it a climate emergency, but hey, we have no other way of dealing with it apart from protesting.
We are living in strange times when our political and economic realities are not matching up with the physical reality we find ourselves in, when we know that we can't keep burning the fossil fuels, can't keep developing them. Even the science, even the economics are saying this, but our politics is not catching up. You've taken it into your own hands to I guess, do what millions of people around the world are asking us to do. Andy, what kind of defence are you running in there? I gather you need expert witnesses and so forth. Who have you called in to help you defend your charges?
Yeah, on the climate crisis, we are using Peter Newman from Curtin University. He's Professor of Sustainability. And on the, the non-violent strategy that we are employing, and that's a core feature of Extinction Rebellion, non-violent and direct action, the non-violent direct action part is also defendable. And we've got Professor Brian Martin, who's a Professor of Social Science at Wollongong University. He'll be appearing as our expert witness. So, yeah, we think we've got a couple of really great experts in their fields, and it's just up to their presentation and how well it influences the magistrate.
To my knowledge, this hasn't been successful in Western Australia before. What do you think your chances are this week?
I think on the climate emergency, I think we've got a good chance of having it acknowledged that, yes, there is a climate emergency. As far as the right to non-violent action, I have my doubts. I think the government cannot, the society, allow the government, is going to say, no, this is not acceptable, because if they did accept it as valid, then we could protest all we like and we would get away with it, if you know what I mean. There'd be no reason apart from trespass, apart from obstructing police and all the rest of those charges, the basic charges, but we would have at least established that there is, that non-violent direct action is a valid method of getting our message across. And I hope that happens.
Thank you, Andy. We hope that the courts will remain independent of government, at least for a little while longer in our society. But we wish you, I guess, all the best in your work this week, and many thanks to yourselves and the rest of the people involved. I believe you have lawyers that are giving their time as well, and we look forward to hearing how it develops. This week, on Wednesday, there is a protest down at Woodside's headquarters. It's a regular thing, Woodside Wednesdays. You can rock on down there around about 10 o'clock, I believe, to join the people down there expressing their opposition to the further development of fossil fuels in this state. And on Friday at 11:30, gathering at Forest Place, Extinction Rebellion are holding a mass outreach activity to spread the word to their fellow humans in the city of Perth about the Burrup Hub and the catastrophe that it would be. Four times the size of the Adani coal mine, and in an instant obliterate Australia's chances of contributing to a safe and fair future for our kids and all the children born around the world, as well as destroying more Aboriginal heritage than has already been taken away from us.
And, Lulu, what time is it? The suspense.
Say 1-1.
It's about 11:42 a.m. Thanks, Lulu. On the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1, myself, Raymond Grenfell, Ewan Buckley, Lulu, and Brahma. Brahma's trying to chime in there over the time as well. And just another 17 minutes left of the program. Going to go to an issue we have long covered on the Indie Media Show now, and that is of our reactionary and aggressive immigration policies and the impact that has had on the lives of many refugees. Today marks 8 years since the federal government changed its asylum seeker policy to disallow anyone who arrives by boat from ever being settled in Australia. This resulted in many people being sort of permanently finding themselves detained on Manus and Nauru, and then resettled or attempted to be resettled in PNG, and it's caused a lot of distress for a lot of people. There were demonstrations around the country, in particular in Brisbane yesterday, to mark the 8-year anniversary. And a little earlier today, I had the opportunity to speak to longtime refugee rights activist and advocate Ian Rintil. And I started by asking Ian, what exactly changed 8 years ago in regard to our asylum and refugee policies?
Well, the immediate thing that that Rudd did was to announce that anybody who was sent offshore would not be able to be, would never be resettled in Australia. That was the thing which changed. There was already people on Manus and and Nauru, but up until that date, people who were found to be refugees were being resettled in Australia. But Rudd's announcement said that anyone who arrived by boat was liable to be sent offshore. The implication at the time actually was that everybody who arrived by boat would be being sent offshore. That's not what actually happened, but anybody who was sent offshore would never be resettled in Australia. So that was a fundamental thing. The Liberals were elected shortly after in September, and then they added Operation Sovereign Borders and the turnbacks to that general policy, making it that bit worse.
And what impact did this have on people's ability to settle down and, I guess, build a life while on things such as temporary visas and I guess further impacts to their ability to reunite with their family members, etc.?
Well, remember the people who were sent offshore, they were just in permanent uncertainty, permanent insecurity, permanent limbo, because although at the time the government was saying that people who were found to be refugees were expected to resettle in Papua New Guinea, that was an impossibility. It was very unclear what was going to happen to the people at Nauru, because at the time the Nauru government was saying that they couldn't be permanently resettled there. So and that's the way it turned out, although they've now got 30-year visas that they will issue at the request of the Australian government, at least. So it meant permanent uncertainty for the people who were sent offshore. It meant, particularly in Manus Island, but in Nauru as well, they were in hostile situations. They were, dangerous and violent situations for the refugees who were, who were sent there. For the people who were sent on shore, I mean, the Liberals actually changed then when they were elected. For the people who were on shore, they abolished the permanent visas, re-established, temporary visas, and then later there was the Safe Haven, enterprise visa, but effect, same temporary visa essentially. And again, it just meant, a very high degree of uncertainty. Those visas had to be renewed every 3 years, every 5 years if they got them. Most of them were prevented from even applying for a visa. Some of them only last year were they even able to apply for a visa, having been, even though they were on the, on the mainland. So again, it was, permanent permanently insecure, and just completely difficult circumstances.
Ian, it's an unfortunate reality that for many of us, we very much follow the media cycle, and if something's not in the news, it's very much not on people's on their mind or in their consciousness. And unfortunately, that seems to be very much the reality with those refugees who found themselves on Manus or Nauru. I'd imagine most people, even myself and other people who are longtime advocates for refugees, aren't even entirely aware of where those refugees are now. You're saying there that some of them have recently received visas, but what is the current state of play for those that have been on Manus and Nauru? I imagine there's different circumstances for different people, some finding resettlement in places such as New Zealand and elsewhere. But can you give us a broad overview of the current sort of state of play for those that had spent time on Nauru or Manus?
They're in very, very difficult circumstances. I mean, even though the campaign has been able to get the vast majority of people, from PNG and from Nauru, to Australia, even though they're still in very difficult circumstances here, they've not got permanent residency, but you've got 233 people who are still in PNG, and Nauru, and there's a big, big question mark hangs over, their future. There is some proportion of them, but it's a shrinking proportion. Perhaps, there's still 20 in Papua New Guinea and, similar number, maybe 15 in Nauru, who have been accepted to the US and are waiting, to be resettled in the US. And New Zealand is not an option at the moment. The Australian government's still preventing that happen, and New Zealand's not willing to go, over the heads of the Australian government. So they're in very, very difficult circumstances. In PNG, we still get episodes of violence, even attacks on hotels where people are being held at the moment. In Port Moresby, we've had the problems with COVID. You've got problems now with people who have got families or brought families with them from Manus when they shifted from Manus to Port Moresby. They've not got jobs. They've not got extra money, to be resettled there, to actually settle in Port Moresby if that's what they wanted to. There's no other third country option. So yes, it's true that the actual circumstances of the people who are on Manus and Nauru is not in the public eye, and the movement, I think, has to constantly raise the fact that we still have to fight for them to get to Australia, for them to get permanent visas when they come here. There's an added problem is that there's a proportion of both the people on Nauru and Manus who are not refugees, even though they've been through the process. They've been rejected in flawed processes, but they have been rejected, which means the difficulties of getting them resettled anywhere is that much higher. It means it's that much bigger effort we have to make to get them to Australia.
We're speaking to Ian Rintoul, who is a long-time refugee rights activist and advocate. Ian, in Brisbane, where you're currently based, there were some anniversary protests yesterday where a few hundred people gathered to mark the 8 years since these changes came into effect. Of course, COVID restrictions being what they are, protests were somewhat limited elsewhere around the country. But we've been talking to you almost as long as this program has been on the air here on Indie Media, and it always comes back to the sort of question of, what is to be done and where is the movement at? You're someone who's been involved in the refugee rights movement for decades. You know, what do you think of the current state of play in terms of the refugee rights movement in Australia? Obviously, it was dealt a very difficult blow with offshore processing and this whole question of refugees being out of sight, out of mind, and that very much sort of affected the refugee rights movement, I believe. But what do you think of the current, I guess, movement here in Australia, and what can be done to perhaps rebuild a refugee rights movement in this country?
Well, they're very difficult times at the moment because there's not, you know, a single focus. You've got people who are Manus and Nauru. You've got, you know, medevac refugees who are still in detention centres or hotels. You've got, other people who still haven't got out of, you know, mainland detention. You've now got people in the community who are equally uncertain because they've not got, you know, permanent visas. So there's no single focus in that respect, and a lot of focus over the past period has been on the medevac refugees because in Melbourne they were plonked in the middle of the city, ultimately Park Hotel. I mean, demonstrations took place in Swanston Street. They're still taking place in, you know, in Melbourne, although there's been a little COVID, you know, have made that somewhat more difficult. So yes, there's not been a single, it's been medevac and perhaps with the Tamil family, Christmas Island now in Perth. But I think we've got one of those situations where I think there's still a very, very high level of understanding in the community, but in terms of actually, you know, mobilising anything like a critical mass which can punch through, I think we've got a form of trench warfare at the moment. That the government has really dug in. They're not willing to do anything with the medevac refugees. They're insisting that the people who are in Manus and Nauru are going to remain there. But we did see, you know, the outcry over the Tamil family. It's possible to shift the government. They're only halfway to freedom, but they're halfway compared to what they were before, and that is largely because of the community outcry there has been. And there simply isn't any alternative, Ray, other than to continue the protest. We've been through ups and downs, you know, before. There have been times when we have looked that we were in a very difficult, impasse against a very intransigent government. But as I like to say, sometimes, you know, the dam wall always looks strongest before it bursts. And you just never know when that protest is finally going to crack that, you know, that facade. And we've got, you know, people on hunger strike in Melbourne. We saw people begin to demonstrate again, last night, you know, in Bide, inside the detention centres, where they've been doing it in a very, very difficult time. So, yeah, there isn't any alternative. We need to keep protesting. It's that which is going to keep it in the public eye. It's going to allow the various groups have been, you know, they've been doing quite well actually over the past period in spite of COVID. But yeah, we've not enough to crack the government yet.
And talking about cracking the government, just finally, Ian, next year there will be a federal election. And while the track record of the ALP is definitely not something that should be commended at all, given that, you know, as we've discussed in this interview, many of the very, regressive or reactionary immigration policies that have been introduced in this country over the years have actually been introduced by the ALP. But is there any indication that the ALP is shifting on this issue towards more humane or humanitarian refugee policies, or do you have any hope that we'll be able to push them and shift them, that, you know, in the chance that the ALP are elected next year, we might end up with better policies on this issue?
Well, I think there's always been one thing that Labor has done when it is in government, and that's get rid of the temporary visas. So, you know, that still remains policy. I'm still quite certain that a Labor government would, you know, abolish temporary visas and convert all the temporary visas to permanent. That would make an enormous difference for tens of thousands of people who are in the community and anyone who is, you know, found to be a refugee in the future. There have been other things which are little indicators, right? I mean, the fact that the Labor Party was willing to vote for the medevac legislation, was a good sign that they could be pushed, that they could be, take more pro-refugee positions. They've not been willing to say publicly yet or establish policy that they will, you know, bring all the, you know, rather grant all the medevac refugees, you know, permanent visas and get them out of the hotels and, you know, in detention. But we did see, a motion moved and supported by the Labor, moved by the Labor in House of Reps and the Senate, calling for the government to actually free, you know, the medevac refugees. So that also was a little bit, you know, a step beyond, you know, that which they still not policy, but it's, you know, they've made a public stance by that voting in Parliament. So we've got no illusions. You know, we've been through this movie before. We had, you know, Rudd elected on very good refugee policies, only to see him follow the Liberals, you know, reopen Christmas Island, reopen offshore processing, even after, you know, even having closed it when he was elected. So people will vote with, you know, no illusions. We need to get rid of Morrison. I mean, it's very clear, you know, that we have to get rid of the LNP government if there's going to be any kind of change. They're still, you know, insist, you know, that stopping the boats is, you know, an electoral, you know, winner for them. I don't think that's the case, you know, anymore. I think there's enough community awareness that indicates, you know, that they, people don't accept, you know, stopping the boats rather. You know, but it's just not that high priority issue that everyone's going to vote on the question of, you know, refugees. So we need to get rid of LNP, but we are going to have to keep, you know, the pressure on to see Labor do, you know, the right thing to actually close offshore, to bring all those people who are stuck on Manus and Nauru, you know, to Australia. And as I said, we need all the people who are stuck on temporary visas in the community to get permanency.
That was Ian Rintoul, longtime refugee advocate and activist based in Brisbane, speaking to us a little earlier today. And that's about all we've got time for on the Indie Media Show this week. Thanks very much for tuning in. Thank you, Ewan and Lulu, for coming in.
Always a pleasure, eh? Thanks, listeners. Thanks, Andy.
And yeah, and also thanks to our other guests, Dr. Tol Harper and Ian Rintoul. There, as I said, we'll be back next week at 11 a.m. Lulu's happy that it's all wrapping up. She gets to go home. I'm sure Brahma's happy as well. Keep it locked, though, as after the news with Sam, Rianne Todhunter is coming up with Out to Lunch, all of your new music needs. As I said, we'll be back next week at 11 a.m. But until then, as we say every week,
don't hate the media.
Become the media. Going to go out with Brahma's favourite track. This is Burgers of Beef. The local heroes never kick the dog. Brahma's sending this one out to his grandma. Have a good day, folks.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?